Welcome to the audio podcast of The Table at Central United Methodist Church. The podcast currently features the messages of Matt Smith and Linda Du Hirsu.
With a musical introduction by Brendan Lowe, our director of music. Thanks for listening. Jesus went on with his disciples to the villages of Caesarea Philippi, and on the way, he asked his disciples, "Who do people say that I am?" And they answered him, "John the Baptist, and others Elijah, and still others one of the prophets." And he asked them, "But who do you say that I am?" And Peter answered him, "You are the Messiah." And Jesus sternly ordered them not to tell anyone about him. Then he began to teach them that the Son of Man must undergo great suffering and be rejected by the elders, the chief priests, and the scribes, and be killed after 3 days rise again. He said all this quite openly, and Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. But turning and looking at his disciples, he rebuked Peter and said, "Get behind me, Satan, for you are setting your mind not on divine things, but on human things."
When you forget my love, I'll try to remind you and stay by you when it don't come easy. When it don't come easy,
What if I told you that what you're about to hear right now is the world's best sermon ever delivered? In 20 minutes or so, you will have heard the best sermon ever delivered ever. It will be better than anything Billy Graham, Joel Osteen, Joyce Meyer, Matt Smith, and Linda Du Hirsu ever came up with on their own in all of their years of ministry combined. What's the first reaction you feel when you hear this, in me saying this? Exactly. You busted yourself. I'll get to it. Well, some of you might think, well, isn't he cocky? Who does this boy think he is? How dare he say that about Matt and Linda and Joyce? There's a small percentage of you that have low expectations of the guest preacher because they're never as good. I would bet money that at least one of you has already apologized to that friend with you that you've invited to join with you, whispering, "I'm sorry, I didn't know there would be a guest." The fact of the matter is, there is a small part of you that expects me to fail. And that's okay. This is a normal feeling. You don't really know me. You don't really know what my qualifications are. Your expectations for preaching are pretty high. You sought out this church over a number of other churches specifically for The Table's messaging. Some of you drive miles just to be here. You want to be educated, entertained, a little provoked, a little challenged, but not too much. And you want it to be somewhat predictable. And you all have decided that it's Matt and Linda that will get you there, at least for now. The interesting thing is, however, that while all of those things are true, at the same time, because the situation is less than ideal, sitting and listening is easier and less rude probably than just getting up and leaving, and supposing I don't ruffle too many feathers, I don't say anything too inflammatory, and I stay within the time limit, you all will be very forgiving. And the reason is because you expect me to fail. At least a little bit. And because of this, you're probably not going to be too upset or heartbroken during the moment or moments when I do. And this is where I want to begin. What exactly are those moments of failure? What causes us to feel them in the first place? When do we meet moments of failure with moments of forgiveness and grace? And how do we move forward after those moments occur? What is it about my performance today, up here in front of all of you, that draws out such forgiveness, allowing all of us to continue failing forward? To start, let's explore this idea of failing. What does it mean exactly? As someone who studies words a lot, I wanted to explore a couple of definitions. It wasn't sitting well with me that so many of us define a concept by so many different terms. Failure, to me, means something completely different than it does to Brian and Sandra and even Eleanor. Failure can't be expressed in a formula, nor can it be a line in the sand. And unfortunately, many realms of society still try. As a side note, I used to be a high school special educator, and through that work, I was tasked with helping general education teachers redefine what it meant for a student to demonstrate their abilities to not fail. Failure could not be Failure could not be arbitrarily defined for my students, impacted in a number of different ways by a number of disabilities. It was not fair, nor was it meaningful, to say that my students with reading disabilities were failing English because privileged readers and learners built a system that left my students entirely out of how they were allowed to demonstrate their proficiency. I worked closely with people and systems, both trying to change and to lessen what it meant to fail. So back to the terms, one definition that I came across called failure a lack of success. I actually really hate this definition. I hate it because it doesn't define failure at all. It just seems to sort of summarize the feeling you have once someone or something has already failed you. Instead, I prefer the old English definition, which draws from the Latin word fallere, which means to fall or to break down. I prefer this so much better because it truly captures the action, not just our emotional response to the action. Now, let me propose this. What if we changed how we use the word failure from a lack of success to only a breaking down of expectations? What does this adjustment of expectations do for us and how we think of failing? If we think of it this way, failing means breaking down and changing expectations that we have in their wake and in their absence, opening up to possibility. Additionally, changing the way we think of failure removes the sting from those moments when we have ourselves been failed. When we remove the feelings of lacking success and we replace them with opportunities for adjustment and change, we might be better prepared for the moments when we fail and when we are failed. So then, given all this, the forward part of failing forward can be a much easier task for us in the lessons that God has to teach. If we think of it this way, failing will always have that forward momentum, allowing God to reveal and to change and to reshape God's expectations for you and of you. This adjustment will also allow you to adjust your expectations of God. So let's put some biblical context around this. In Mark, the verses that we just read, we see a scene in which Jesus and his friends are traveling around Jerusalem, healing the blind, feeding the hungry, and doing the work that Jesus has claimed many times to be sent to earth to do. During all of this, Jesus asks his friends, "What do you call me?" To which Peter replied, "You're the Messiah." At this moment, though, Jesus sternly ordered him and all who were around not to tell anyone about this. The Bible explains that he then began to teach them the real purposes of the Son of Man, a title by which Jesus refers to himself. For context, the title Son of Man is used to counter the title of Messiah a number of different times. Why might this be that Jesus refuses the name Messiah? Jesus explains that the purpose of his work is not to be the Messiah or the anointed one. That's what Messiah means. It means to literally be the oiled one, the anointed one. While scholars disagree somewhat on the full definition, Christian history tells us that the title of the Son of Man was believed to mean that Jesus came to earth to serve humankind. The title referred Jesus to a humble and lower status. To be anointed was to be set apart in an earthly position of superiority. This being in opposition to the sole purpose of Jesus' ministry as he saw it. Ironically, though, Jesus came to fight against the very authority that was in place socially and placed upon him personally through the title of Messiah. When Jesus sternly replies to Peter, the readers are left to wonder why Peter did such a thing. It feels impossible to believe that Peter, after having traveled with Jesus for some time now, would have made an error like that. If you're anything like me, you might have even been a little intimidated that Jesus, who knew and understood the hearts and minds of his followers, would ever rebuke someone he loved. By our accounts, it would seem that Peter failed. Here is the first opportunity we will take to think about what it means to fail forward with this new definition in mind. It seems to me that Jesus is encouraging Peter and the others to break down and change the expectations people have of his ministry. Instead of desiring a king, Jesus is encouraging people to remember and know that he is first and foremost a savior. He is not there to serve the needs of his own ego, nor is he there to serve the needs of power and hierarchy. But instead, he is there to serve the sick and the hurting and the dying. The region already had kings and governments. They had authority and rules. They had hierarchy and order. Jesus, as the Son of Man, used his God-given abilities to do away with order for the sake of people, to let go of hierarchy for the sake of humility. This is why Jesus was stern. I don't think he was admonishing Peter. I think he was trying to be explicitly clear about who he was and what he was expecting from his followers in order to have the kind of ministry that he needed. If we reframe this moment not as Peter failing in the traditional sense, but instead as Jesus realigning and breaking down his mission for his followers, it provides us as readers the opportunity to do the same in our own lives. As little Christs, let us read into this moment a reminder that we too should remain humble in the wake of ego. And remember that the entire purpose of our lives, if we are to live like Jesus called us to live, is to serve people in the way that he served them. That we too should be children of humankind. And as I always like to remind people, we are much more like Peter than we are like Jesus in this story. Let us always remember that when we read stories of people making mistakes in the Bible, we should always think about ourselves as the person being corrected and not as the person doing the correcting. So, on that note, I don't want to stand up here acting like I haven't struggled with the same sense of ridiculously high expectations that need constant adjusting. My partner Ryan could go on and on about my high expectations and how failing forward is a constant battle in our relationship, I'm sure. Ask him after service. I'm sure he'd love to share a few of those with you. That being said, I certainly have a defining moment in my own spiritual journey in which I was forced to learn this lesson of both feeling failed by God and having to break down my own expectation of what it means to accept that God's plans are not my own. My mother was a woman who struggled with both mental and physical pain most of her life. Having experienced abuse from childhood into her adult life and being diagnosed with osteoarthritis in her mid-40s, to say she had a difficult path is putting it gently. As the eldest son with no family of my own at the time, I took on the responsibility of supporting my mother emotionally. I did everything I could to support her and encourage her along her journey. This was not an easy task by any stretch of the imagination. Because she struggled with both mental and physical illnesses, she was always battling the desire to give up. There were moments when I felt like I was solely responsible for her health, and because of this, her life, even more so than she seemed to be at times. I stayed awake at night wondering what would happen if I wasn't around or didn't care as much as I did. And while I certainly had other siblings that loved and cared for my mom, it seemed as though my mom placed me in this position of caretaker as well. It was certainly both a blessing and a giant burden. Because of this, my relationship with my mom was largely the focus of my prayer life and my relationship with God. During the roughest years, I prayed on my hands and knees every single day without missing even one. I read the Bible every day for 2 years. The depths of my soul wanted nothing, not one single thing, more than for my mom's mental and physical pain to end. She deserved more. I deserved more. My family deserved more. I worked my tail off for that. I prayed with her every time I left her. I prayed for her when we were apart. And I had dreams and visions of what she would be like in her older age, free from the burdens of her pain. And after all that, on January 21st, 2012, my mom passed away. At the height of the worst pain I'd ever experienced in my life, I was also forced to grapple with the fact that I thought I had done everything right. I did what I knew to do and nothing worked. I felt betrayed. I felt lied to. And I felt like I truly failed as both a son and as a believer. I was fully dedicated to my Christian life, and this was the first time I did not feel the same thing in return. I was heartbroken and so disappointed in God. For the year that followed, my spiritual journey changed drastically. I no longer read my Bible. I no longer did those prayers. Honestly, I had no idea what to even pray for anymore. I didn't know what it was for, what was it for if praying deeply for the well-being of those I loved produced nothing. I didn't know what the point was when, in the end, God was going to do what God was going to do. And in this very thought, through the rubble and the grief of a spiritual life broken down, my mind shifted. What if God had a plan that was bigger and more beautiful than the plan I had for myself? What if God truly had a plan for me, for my mother, for my spiritual journey, for mental health more broadly, for physical pain and treatment more broadly? How much more pain would my mom be in if she didn't pass away then? What if my mom passing away was the answer to prayers, both hers and mine? It was in my moments of struggle with what it all meant that I was able to get to these questions in what I would consider a truly authentic way. In short, what if I allowed God to be God and I altered my prayer life so that it reflected that instead of what I wanted life and God to be? What if I let God be God? And what if I humbled myself enough to accept that I was not in control? This space of adjusting my expectations around a spirituality that is God-driven has not been an easy road. But wow, it has been so much more fruitful and beautiful and peaceful. It is in this very spiritual journey, along with the help of mental health professionals, that I sought out to help me cope with my grief, that has allowed me to see not only my mom's death, but most of tragedy as both deeply heartbreaking and profoundly beautiful. It has allowed me to trust in a greater vision of the world, a vision that has me as an active participant and not as its spiritual center. It has me in a much more humble and open space. I don't want to say that it's lowered my expectations of God. Instead, this journey has taught me to alter what I expect from myself in an active relationship with the divine and in the world around me. And ever since this horrible year, which led to such a drastic spiritual shift, I was able to change what I considered failure in many parts of my life. I was able to see where I had expectations of God that were not necessarily the expectations I felt like God had for me and the world around me. Seeing God as failure in these ways has allowed my heart to be cracked open to perspectives that I maybe wouldn't have had without having gone through such a deep and life-changing disappointment. Some of these include more compassion for my family and my partner, more concern for the well-being of others as they interact with me in my world, more openness to possibility, more sympathy for others who might be praying just as hard for their issues in their life as I was praying for issues in my own, even when I disagree with those issues, and more diversity in how I see God in the world. And please don't get me wrong, I'm not saying God wants tragedy in our lives. Instead, I think that God teaches us how to act and react to a world where tragedy, disappointment, and even failure are defined by the individual. What's failure to me in my perspective might not be the same for you or for your neighbor and even for God. If I believe all things work together for the force of good and love, which I call God, then I must also believe that it is my responsibility to seek out those moments of goodness and love in the face of moments I previously considered failures. What are those moments for you in your life where God might be calling you to adjust your belief of failure? What are those moments that are begging you to shift how you see yourself and your relationship to God and the purpose of your life? What lessons can you take from Peter's failure that gives space for us to see God in a new way? That also inspires us to remember that we are called for a more humble space. And what about moments of beauty might you open yourself up to when you're breaking those expectations down? As you consider what it means to break down and change your own concepts of failure, both personally and for those around you, much like you have done for me today, I pray that you can see the possibility for grace and forgiveness and love in these changes and in your connection to the beauty of God. Amen.
Down by
the riverside,
down by the riverside,
I'm going to lay down my head.